Good morning, diners and travelers, wherever you are. This is Ann Haig on the menu. I have also my first guest on the line, Dory Greenspan, who's probably one of the most respected bakers that I know of in the whole industry. Hello, Dory.
Hi, happy to be with you.
Yes. Now, you have this book out, which everyone's already calling a classic forever book, called Baking From My Home to Yours.
I'm very excited about this book.
This book is, I wanted to tell you, one of our local food writers here said, oh, you're talking to Dory, tell her that I absolutely adore her books and that all of her recipes work.
I wish you could see the smile on my face. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I mean, that's a compliment, I think.
That's a huge compliment.
It is.
And that's, I mean, we all write cookbooks with the hope that, you know, people will use them, make the recipes, and love what they make. So that's the best compliment.
I thought it was probably true, too.
Thank you for passing it along.
Now, it says that this is your 9th cookbook, but it's very different from all your others.
Both of those facts is true, are true. It is my 9th book, and it's different from the others in that this is really a collection of my recipes over the past 30 years, things I've been making in my own kitchen with lots of help from great pastry chefs I've worked with and friends and relatives who've shared recipes with me over the years. But this one's really very, very personal, and it feels like if I were neater, I would have kept a kitchen journal. So this feels like the kitchen journal that I probably should have kept over the years. It really is like my scrapbook.
Uh-huh.
And it's different from so many other books that I've done because I've done a lot of collaborations, wonderful, wonderful collaborations with great people. So I worked
Julia
with
Julia Child, yeah.
No, I mean, I worked with Danielle Ballou doing the Kathy Ballou cookbook, and I did 2 books with Pierre Hermé. And
oh, yes.
I worked with Julia Child on the Baking with Julia book. So this book is, after many years, all mine.
Yes, and you had a late start into, well, not late. But
no,
I mean,
it was late. No, you're right. It was a late start.
Well, you were 19, right?
Well, I was 19. I thought you meant a late start into baking professionally.
Yes, well,
I had a very early start into marriage, which was,
yeah.
I was 19 when I got married, and that's when I started cooking.
Yes, and then you went, you were getting a doctorate, and then you had a revelation. Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, I was doing a doctorate in gerontology, and I thought I was going to work in a university or a research center, and I was working on my dissertation. And I was, that's the one deadline I didn't meet. I never got it written. And I didn't get it
I never finished mine either.
I never, what was yours then?
Art history.
Art history. Well, I never finished it, I think, because I really, I must have known deep down in my toes somewhere that that wasn't what I wanted to do with my life, and I really wanted to bake. And it was at a time when I went to look for a job as a baker, it was a time when it was very hard for a woman to get a job in a kitchen.
You have some really funny stories about the man, the one who talked to you only in French saying, I want a boy.
I'm looking for a boy. And, you know, I'm kind of a skinny, short-haired person, but I don't look like a boy. And so finally, I let him go on, and finally I said to him, you know, I'm not a boy. And he said, yes, and that's the reason you won't get this job.
And then the other story was about you got hired because you were a skinny pastry chef.
Oh, I got hired at a great restaurant that was owned by 2 women. And the first day on the job, one of the owners came by and said, oh, how chic, a skinny pastry chef. I also got fired from that job, however.
Yeah, for creative insubordination, which I thought was pretty funny.
Yeah, but hiring and firing were, there wasn't much time in between. Yeah, I was making their signature cake, which was this wonderful cake, actually a cake from Simone Beck's book, Cuisine, cake with ground almonds and chocolate, a torte, and it had rum-soaked raisins in it. It was really the restaurant's signature cake, but I was getting a little tired of making it every day, so I swapped the, instead of almonds, I used pecans. I probably could have gotten away with that, but instead of rum-soaked raisins, I used Armagnac-soaked prunes.
Oh, my, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, prunes aren't exactly everyone's favorite fruit. And then the other thing I did was I never told anybody I did that. So when they brought up the cake and served it, there were a lot of unhappy diners.
You're mischievous, aren't you, Dory?
I was mostly just bored and trying to entertain myself. But yeah, I got fired. I guess if I had been the boss, I might have fired me too.
Oh, dear. Now, tell us about the organization of this book.
Well, it's interesting to me. I kept going around and around about how to organize the book. And in the end, came up deciding that it should really be fairly classically organized, in that we don't really wake up in the morning and say, I'm looking for something crunchy, crumbly, and chewy, you know, so that the chapters are fairly classic in that I have breakfast sweets. I love that chapter with biscuits and muffins and scones and a few yeast cakes, cookies, cakes, pies and tarts, and then what I call spoon desserts, puddings and custards and crisps and ice cream. But within each chapter, the recipes are, the chapters are divided. So within cookies, I have cookies that you shape, cookies that you drop, tons of bar cookies. I have like seven, if you count blondies as brownies, I have 17 brownie recipes.
Wow.
And then each recipe has, or most of the recipes, has a little section at the end called playing around.
I was going to ask you about that. That's fun. Go ahead.
I think that's fun. And that gives people a chance to kind of make the recipe their own, to change a flavor or a spice or maybe the shape. And each of the recipes has information on how to store it, how to keep it, and how, if it's possible, to make it ahead. Because I want the whole world to bake. I feel like a baking evangelist sometimes. And so I want to make it as easy as possible for people to get into the kitchen and bake something that they're going to love. And sometimes we just don't have a lot of time for baking, so it's nice to know what can be made ahead, what can be frozen, what can be put aside for a few days, how you can break up a recipe into chunks that are really workable and make that, you know, part of your life.
Yeah, we just interviewed Ann Amernick about her new book.
She's so great.
She is, but she's
so talented.
She is, but she, you know, we were talking about this Graham, how put off most American bakers are with the weight.
You know, I would love to see us go from volume measures, or at least coexist, have volume measures and weight measures coexist.
Yeah, well, she did that in her book, and I think that was a good move. But, I mean, I've had endless discussions, and as far as the experts tell me, you need to weigh stuff.
It's just, you know, it's so much easier. It's hard for us to think about it because as Americans, we're so unaccustomed to it.
Yeah.
But it really makes getting ready to do something a cinch. You just put a bowl on a scale, measure in the flour, press the little button that zeros it, measure in the baking powder, measure. It's just, it's less bowls, less work, more accurate. But I don't think it's going to happen. And so, you know, I live happily with cups and spoons.
Yeah. This, I must comment on two other things. One is the photography is to die for. Absolutely exquisite.
I had the dream team working on this book. The photographs are by Alan Richardson, and he's just fabulous. And the food styling was done by Karen Tack, and they're a great team, and they just got what I really wanted for this book, because these are really, you know, as the title says, from my home to yours, these are really homey, make-at-home desserts. These aren't fancy restaurant recipes. And they really, in the photography, got this sense of what these desserts are about. I remember.
Yeah, I mean, they're crumbs sitting next to the coffee cake.
I went into the studio and was looking at some of the photographs, and Karen and Alan said to me, you know, we read they were reading it in manuscript. We read your manuscript, and we decided that you wouldn't mind if everything wasn't perfect, if things weren't cut precisely, and if there were crumbs on the plate. And I said, that's exactly what things are like in my kitchen, and that's what I want the book to look like.
Yeah,
they look great.
Here's a knife used for cutting the cake with all the smear of the icing and the crumbs on it.
Well, that's the way it would be at home, wouldn't
it? Exactly. I love it. I mean, Do you think, by the way, that there is a return to this kind of homey, real desire for this kind of homey baking?
And I think so. I certainly hope so. And the kind of response that I've gotten, I was lucky enough to travel around the country when the book came out, and I got to talk to people. And I think this really is, I think there are, you know, there are bakers who want the challenge of a restaurant recipe, and there are great books out that have those kinds of challenging, I call it project baking, you know, those kinds of recipes. This book is really for people who want to bake for their friends and family.
Yeah, I love this mixed berry cobbler where it's spilling out over them.
I love that picture. But and it's exactly,
it's true.
You know, it's exactly the way it looks. And I think even the word cobbler, the name, you know, gives you the sense of something very rustic and homey and not perfect.
Here you've got cobblers, crumbles, crisps, and shortcakes in this.
Somebody
one
once called me the queen of alliteration.
Oh dear. And then the other thing is, I might say, is this glossary. I don't think you left anything out.
Well, the glossary is it's a, you know, terms and equipment and techniques. I was really hoping that people who were not competent bakers, or that's probably the wrong thing, but people who were just starting out, even people who might have been a little fearful about starting to bake. I was hoping they'd be seduced by this book, and then once seduced, I wanted to help them be successful. And the glossary really is the section to turn to if you're a first timer, or if you haven't baked for a while and your skills are rusty, and you just want to check up on how you should do things. I really enjoyed working on that part of the book because it really made me think about what goes into baking and what kind of help people might need. You know, when my recipes are a little longer than some other people's recipes, and it's because I like to imagine as I'm writing a recipe that I'm actually in the kitchen with the person baking whatever it is that the recipe is for. And so I like to feel like I'm there with them, helping them along and giving them all the information that they need to be a success.
Could you hold the thought for a minute, Dora, while
sure.
we take a commercial break?
Oh, sure.
And then we'll come back on the other side.
Okay.
We'll take a break. Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Anne Haig. Remember to check out our website, www.onthemenuradio.com. And I'm talking now to Dori Greenspan, who's a delight, and she has a fabulous book called Baking From My Home to Yours. And if you buy one baking book in the world, buy this one. And you can just go directly to our website and click, and you'll go directly to Amazon, and you can buy this book. And if you take a look at these pictures, and it's just everything you want to make these kinds of comfortable home baking baked goods. Dori, after that, let's go back to your story about how you write so that you're like, actually, you feel like you're in the room with the home baker.
I try to imagine myself in the kitchen with the baker. I try to imagine myself giving him or her all the information they need, because, you know, baking is, for some people, I sometimes think the world is divided into cooks and bakers.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And that, you know, some people want to bake, but they're unsure of themselves, or they haven't done it before. And so I like to think of myself sitting on their shoulders, cheering them on, and giving them that information so they can be successful.
Oh, that's funny. Now, when I said that everybody raved about this book, I mean, here's a Pierre Hermé says, a Bible of sweets. You have Daniel Boulou, a new classic for your kitchen and mine, too. Patricia Wells, an abundant, enthusiastic mix of butter, sugar, nuts, fruits, spices, warmth, and love.
You know, I mean, blushing, but you can't see me.
Oh, and Emily Lucchetti and Francois Payard. I mean, all these, Gail Gant, I mean, this is a treasure.
Well, it was really a treat for me. I was to be able to write this. I was I feel very lucky that I was given the chance to do this because, I mean, it's a big book. And
how many recipes? It is a big book.
It is a big book. It's about 300 recipes, and it's About 4.5 pounds. I think when you go to Amazon, you see that it's, I've never put it on a scale. They give it, I think, as 4.5 pounds. So it's, and it's got over 100 photographs. So it's really big. And I was just delighted that, this is what, you know, the publisher allowed me to do.
Uh-huh. And this is the cake you're talking about, the chocolate Armagnac cake?
Yep, that's the one that got me fired.
It sounds good to me.
It's such a good cake, and it's good in both versions. I mean, the classic with the rum-soaked raisins and almonds is great. And I do give you the recipe for that, and then the recipe for the cake that got me fired, which is the one that has pecans and those delicious Armagnac-soaked prunes.
Well, you know, you must have had a lot more pastries in your home cooking experience than I've ever had. I mean, what is visiting cake?
This is such a great recipe. I had never heard of this recipe. I had met a woman in Connecticut, and she wanted, we had just redone our kitchen. She was in the process of doing hers. She said, "Can I come see your sink?" And so I invited her over, and she came with the Swedish visiting cake. And it is, I don't think there's a simpler cake in the world. It comes together in about 6 minutes. And she told me that her mother, she's Swedish and grew up in Sweden, that her mother used to say about this cake that when you saw your visitors coming up the road, you could start making this cake, put it in the oven, and by the time everyone got settled, it would be ready to serve. It's a great cake. It's a very plain, kind of spongish cake that you just mix together in a bowl, and it has some almonds put over the top. I make it in a cast iron skillet, which I think makes it look even more inviting.
Uh-huh.
And it's as plain as could be, and yet there's something so wonderful and wholesome and warm and friendly about this cake. I have gotten more letters from home bakers about this cake than almost any other recipe in the book. People just love it. It's impossible.
It's really sort of jumped out at me.
It's impossible to do anything wrong to it. It always comes out, and it's just, it's so good in its simplicity.
You know, the other thing is, I don't have a real sweet tooth, but I do love lemon tarts.
Oh.
And you have this recipe here that sounds, it almost tempts me to start baking.
Oh, come on in. Come on into the kitchen. You can do it. No, actually, I have a few lemon tarts because I also love lemon. The tart that I call the most extraordinary lemon cream tart, that recipe comes from Pierre Hermé, and it's just a marvel. It's made like lemon curd, but instead of melting the butter with the lemon ingredients the way it's classically done in curd, you make what the French would call a cream, a lemon cream.
Mm-hmm.
Then you cool it down. It's made the same way as curd. Then you cool it down a little bit, put it in a blender, and add the butter while the blender is going whir, 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 whir.
Uh-huh.
And so instead of melting the butter, you're really emulsifying it. You're making almost like mayonnaise.
Interesting.
And so the way the butter melts on your tongue once it's incorporated is completely different from the way it does in curd. I love that recipe.
Yeah, it looks good.
And then I have a recipe for a lemon tart in which you use the entire lemon, everything but...
Is that the tartest?
It's the tartest lemon tart, right?
Yeah, see, I like really tart lemon tarts.
Well, this one has pucker power.
Okay, that's always good.
You can turn down the page on that one.
Okay.
And again, easy because the filling is just, everything goes into the blender, and all you need to do is be able to push a button.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, you have, probably everybody's going to be interested in how many different apple pies or pastries do you have?
You know, I didn't count, but I did get a little carried away, I think. I do love apples. So I have apple in a bundt cake. I love that cake, actually. It's chunks of apple.
Oh, I saw that, yes.
And apple butter and apple juice or cider as well. And I have an all-American apple cake, apple pie, rather, you know, a tall...
This is exactly what my mother's apple pies used to look
really?
Like.
Really?
Yes.
You know, my mom didn't bake at all, so I truly started from scratch. She didn't cook either. That apple pie is my idea of what a real apple pie should look like, but it's not one I grew up with. So that's with a really
flaky... But that's the one I grew up with.
Oh, I love the crust on this, too.
Yeah.
And then I had
but
some
we did this thing talk. Thing. We had this funny thing that sometimes, not always, but sometimes, my father wanted cheddar cheese on a square of it on top. Is that funny? On the when the pie's still warm.
Yep, that's to me. I always think of that as being kind of Midwestern, but it might be New England as well. I'm not sure, but it's a great combination to have cheddar and
it's funny,
you know, that little bit of tang that you get from cheddar cheese with the sweetness of apples. Great combination.
Wow.
And then, you know, I have some French apple tarts. I have a tart tatin, which is the upside down apple. I did get a little carried away. but it was fun to get carried away with apples.
Yeah, but I mean, you tackle some of the real basics here, like these layer cakes. Do you have any tricks on those?
But, you know, it's funny you say tackle because in the end, they turn out to be pretty easy. And their layer cakes are fun because you can make the layers and put them aside. Just keep them at room temperature.
Right.
And then you can make the filling and frosting, and you can tuck the whole thing into the refrigerator. And some of the layer cakes can even get put into the freezer, totally made. So when you open your freezer, you just look in, and it's like there's a party going on in there.
Oh, that's
so
cute.
So you can work ahead and have the cake ready. I like that you know, so it was, I guess, Karim who said that, who was a great French pastry chef in the, I want to say, 18th century?
No, 19th.
And he said that pastry is related to architecture. And I think you see that with layer cakes and the whole sense of building the dessert. And the same way that Rome wasn't built in a day, a layer cake doesn't have to be built in a day, which I think is so convenient.
Yes. I've made two layer cakes in my life, the same one twice, and it was 12 layers, and it had buttercream, and it had, marzipan in between, and then it was glazed with apricot or something, and you couldn't cut it, of course, and it was so rich that my husband claims it gives you pimples for 2 years.
Austrian, actually, with the apricot glaze and the marzipan.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I put it out of my mind. I don't know where it
is. But you did it twice.
I did it twice, and that was it. So, but now you even have photographs here of unbaked dough and these wonderful, boy, I mean, your food stylist did a great job with these the vessels.
Well, it's interesting because, as I said, she and the photographer, Karen Tack, the food stylist, and Alan Richardson, the photographer, really read everything, and we talked and talked, and they really got a sense of what I wanted for this book and my style of baking, which is just, as I said, very, very homey, very casual, somewhat rustic. And so they really went from there. I love the picture of the dough rising in the it's Kugelhopf dough,
okay,
and it's which is a yeast coffee cake,
okay,
kind of like brioche, very much like brioche actually, but not as rich, and made in a swirly twirly turban kind of bundt cake pan, you know,
right. Did you laugh at that, the whole bundt thing and my big fat Greek wedding?
I'm sorry, wait, I didn't hear.
My big fat Greek wedding, the bundt cake. I mean, every time I see a bundt cake now, I get hysterical.
But, you know, it's so interesting because there's been such an interest in bundt cakes lately and such of the kinds of, and maybe it came after that.
Probably.
Explosion in the shapes of the kinds of pans that you can buy and the whimsical shapes. And I'm delighted because I love bundt cakes, and I think that, you know, they're very easy to make, and they look so terrific because the pans are such great shapes. So you as the baker have nothing to do but mix up the batter, and then the pan does everything to make it look fabulous.
Did you see the latest brownie pan?
No.
That came out. It looks kind of like a jigsaw, sort of interconnected jigsaw, and it's for people who like the crispy corners. It creates more crispy corners.
What a great idea.
It's kind of...
I love anything that will get more people in the kitchen baking.
Uh-huh.
Well, I just think that, you know, baking, there's such satisfaction in baking. And, yeah.
You've convinced us. And, Dory, I can't tell you how much fun I've had talking to you about this.
Well, I want you to try a different layer cake. That's your assignment.
Okay, that's my assignment.
Not back to that 12-layer one.
So anyhow,
it's so great to talk to you.
And you too, and everybody can latch on to your book from our website, www.onthemenuradio.com. And you are a delight, Dory, and I hope to talk to you again.
I hope so too. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll take a break. Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Anne Haig today, solo. Peter's in Dallas. I'm talking to Laurie Vick, and I'm so glad you called, Laurie.
Well, thank you so much for allowing us this opportunity. I'm at University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio, Director of Media and Public Relations, and we are really excited to tell you about our upcoming event, which is Five Star Sensation, which is a culinary extravaganza that happens every other year here in Cleveland, with all the proceeds benefiting our Ireland Cancer Center. And Wolfgang Puck, the chef to the stars, is returning again this year, as he has every year, to be in charge of this great event.
And Barbara, too, is she co-chair?
She is an honorary chair as well. And
is
they've
she coming?
Been with this since its inception in 1987. So
oh,
we're
wow,
just
that's
so
a long
pleased
time.
That they have thrown so much support behind this. They,
now, how this, would they get involved with this since they're in California?
They are. Well, their dear friend, Carol Carr, who is our chairperson here in Cleveland, brought it to their attention, and Wolf just fell in love with the idea and has been so connected and committed to it ever since. And this year, my goodness, he's invited. Now we have 35 chefs from the finest restaurants all over and 40 vintners joining. So every year it just grows and grows.
Yeah, well, we're going to be there.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And tell me a little bit, since I've never been before, what the evening is like. It's an evening event. It's a one evening event.
It is an evening event, and this year it is going to take place at the site of our future hospital, a new hospital that we're building called the Ahuja Medical Center. So it is going to be under a huge tent, and in order to get it's really quite a logistical miracle that this comes together. But all of the chefs and the vintners do all of their preparation at our stadium, the Cleveland Browns Stadium, and then the food is transported out to the site of the event, and we expect some 2,000 people last
oh, wow.
time. Yes, 1,500, and we sold out so quickly that we have expanded it to allow for 2,000 guests.
Is this a construction site?
It is.
Oh,
yes.
Is there a wooden floor down?
We're going to make sure that, because you never know in June in Cleveland whether we might have rain or what we're going to have.
We had.
But, yeah.
I mean, I saw, we were at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival.
Oh.
It poured.
Oh.
And in the tent, people were walking around with designer shoes.
Oh.
In mud up to their ankles.
Oh, well, you won't have to worry about that. We're used to inclement weather in Cleveland, so we're definitely making sure all our bases are covered. But just an amazing event this is.
So specifically, and what happens? I mean, you have 35 chefs. Do they each have like a booth, or do they all work
they have
on
a table.
Dinner?
So you have stations all around,
okay.
And you have the 40 vintners, so they are set up as well. And the chefs start preparing their food on Friday, whatever they can do, of course, ahead. And then it's all shipped in refrigerated trucks and brought to the site early Saturday morning, and throughout the day Saturday is all the prep, and it's beautiful. Just, the floral arrangements, everything, and such concentration on the presentation that it's really quite magnificent to see.
And when does it open?
Pardon me?
When does it start?
It starts at 7 p.m.
Wow.
On June 23rd, and then the guests roam at will and sample from everyone.
Uh-huh.
So it's quite an event that we starve for quite a few days in advance to be able to sample from all of this. But you know,
and there's dancing. There's dancing.
There's dancing, and there is
What kind of dancing will you have?
Well, we have an area that is set aside for that. It's really the beauty of having a construction site is we're not confined by walls. So we have enormous tenting, and we have music playing continuously, and there is a raffle, and there is a car that has been donated to be raffled off. So really, it's a very large community event as well.
Now, how much money do you raise from this?
Well, this year, the goal is $2 million for this one evening.
Wow.
And I will tell you that...
The tickets are pricey, though, aren't they?
They range anywhere from $300 to $1,000.
Oh, okay.
And we do find that, of course, many of our philanthropic... Cleveland has a very fabulous philanthropic community.
Yeah, you've got the Gooden Foundation.
We have quite a bit here of support, and so we do find a very generous community here in Cleveland. But over the years, since this has been happening since 1987, they've raised more than $6 million for the Ireland Cancer Center.
It's amazing.
It is.
And I'm looking at this list of... celebrity chefs here.
Uh-huh.
Floyd Cardoz, he was just in the Share Our Strength. Mm-hmm. Vincent Gerto, Vincent's on Camelback, I know him as.
Right. Uh-huh.
Gordon Hammersley from Boston. It just goes on. Sean McClain from Chicago. Mark Peel from Campanile.
Can you imagine having all these great chefs?
No, Lydia Shire. That was fabulous.
Yeah, and this year Paul Prudhomme is joining us. And I'm not sure whether that information this is just a new edition, which we're very excited about.
Now, if people want more information about this, first of all, the date is when?
June 23rd.
That's right, and Saturday night.
Saturday night, and 7 p.m.
Now, we do have you can give the website up, but we do have a direct link, I believe, on our website, which is www.onthemenuradio.com.
Great.
But what is, you might as well give it out anyhow.
Sure. It is www.5starsensation.com.
Right. And have you been with the group a long time? Or?
I have not, so this is going to be my first visit, but my goodness, I have lived it through photos. My appetite is really piqued at this.
Now, you were formerly a television person?
I was, actually. I was a news anchor and reporter with Fox News for 16 years.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So how is this? This must be a change of pace for you.
Well, it is, and now I'm on the other side of the camera, you see, but I have a good understanding of what the media wants, so uh-huh. It works out well, but I'm enjoying it, and my goodness, to be associated with university hospitals and this event, the Ireland Cancer Center, they do such wonderful work, and it's only one of 39 centers like it in the country.
What is distinctive about it? I did read something is distinctive, but I couldn't remember what it was.
Yeah, well, we are a designated National Cancer Institute, and which is one of 39 in the country, and the Ireland Cancer Center started in 1985, and we really do amazing work here, and it's not just the work we do in treating patients, but our primary affiliate, which is the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, it allows us to have a wonderful collaboration for research, and the Ireland Cancer Center is an integral part of the Case Comprehensive Cancer Center, which is a research institute. So we clearly bring work right from the bench to the bedside, and that is a very large distinction for the Ireland Cancer Center.
Well, it sounds sublime. I'm really looking forward to it. Check the website, listeners, for more information and to get your tickets. There's still some tickets, Laurie?
There still are some tickets, but as I say, we can only do this once every other year because it's such a large event to put together, but sold out, so we are looking forward to that same kind of response this year.
Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to it, and listeners, it's going to be casual and creative, I think, is the attire.
That's what they say.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And
so we'll see a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Well, Laurie, I look forward to meeting you.
I do as well, Anne.
And I will be there on the 23rd.
Great. You'll be in for a good time.
Oh, yeah. Our anniversary is the day before.
What a great way to celebrate.
Yeah. And so we're going to go visit our friend at the Baricelli Inn.
Oh, my
Paul
goodness.
Manella.
Oh, yes, yeah. And he does a great job as well. I hope you'll be overnighting there. That's such a
lovely
place.
Yes, that's what we're going to do.
Great. Enjoy.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to seeing you.
I look forward to meeting you as well, Anne. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, you know, usually we have things that I never get to talk about, which we used to call stuff, except somehow or other we weren't allowed to do that anymore. Does everybody follow all the lists of bests of? Because you need to know where you're going to go when you're traveling around, which chefs you're going to do. The Food and Wine Best Chefs this year is April Bloomfield of the Spotted Pig in New York, Gabriel Bremer of Salts in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Steve Corey, 555 Portland, Maine, Matthew Dillon, Sitka and Spruce in Seattle, Gavin Kaysen at El Bizococo, Bizococho in San Diego. I've been in San Diego a lot, and I've never been to that one. Johnny Monas of Comey in D.C., Sean O'Brien of Myth in San Francisco. I'm going to have to go there, too. Gabriel Rucker of La Pigeona in Portland, Oregon. And that's a great restaurant town. Ian Schnobelin, Iris in New Orleans, which we missed last time but intend to really go to this time. Paul Verrant of V in Western Springs, Illinois, which I am reading raves about. That was one of the things I had listed for stuff. Some of the stuff I even forgot why I listed it to. Do you know that the Old Ways, who they've been on our program from time to time, they helped to create these pyramids, the food pyramids, for different cultures now, which is, I mean, it's all well and good to have the food pyramid set up for the average American diner, but how do you get all the right things in the right proportions if you're a Latino family? So now there is a new supermarket shopping guide launched called Camino Magico to help Latinos eat healthy. Now that's interesting. I think that they always also have in the works I know they have an Asian food pyramid, and now they're going to come out with one of these supermarket guide things too for the Asians. What else have we not said here? I think we already talked about sharing good stories and helping to feed people. Let's see, the best stories in Pittsburgh will be featured on the Sharing News Network, and that's on our website. Just scroll down in the update section, and you'll get to see that. Food trends we never seem to talk much about. The one that I've been dying to try, but I haven't found anybody willing to point me in the direction of, is the hot new cheese, is reindeer cheese. I'm not sure. It's called Giustoleipa. Giustoleipa, and I'm not sure how you say that. It's Finnish, and it's it's like a classic cheese from Finland. And with that bit of fancy information, I'm going to call for a break. Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Anne Haig and my new guest, who's Alfred Zappala, who's a man after my own heart because he has a company called All Things Sicilian. Hi, Alfred.
Hi, Anne. How are you?
Oh, great. Tell us a little bit about your company. Are you an importing company?
Yes, we're an importing company, and we also an internet company. Our address is www.allthingssicilian.com.
Okay, so people can order products
right online. But we started this project 5 years ago, myself and several other colleagues of mine in the Boston area, to fight against the stereotyping that programs like The Sopranos put out about Sicilian people.
I see.
Myself being an attorney and a Sicilian, the inference has been throughout my career, you know, fill in the blanks, mafioso.
Uh-huh.
So we started All Things Sicilian to really fight against that stereotype and to introduce to the American market what the wonders of Sicily.
Yeah, well, my background happens to be Sicilian,
bravo.
And I should be so lucky as to have good mafia connections. I think
you have good genes. That's great.
Tell me this.
I work with the Sicilian government, the Italian government, primarily the Sicilian government. Yeah, I happen to have a dual citizenship, Italian and American, And 5 years ago, we identified several wonderful companies from Sicily, and we began the process of importing their products into America.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, now Sicily has a 22% unemployment rate, Ann. Could you imagine if America had a 22% unemployment rate?
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah.
So we feel that we're accomplishing two purposes. Number one, we're introducing America to Sicily, and number two, we're creating jobs in Sicily.
Uh-huh. Can you give us a real quick crash course on the sweet and sour history of Sicilian food, which you nicely sent to me?
Sure. Sicilian food is, I mean, basically,
it's everything. It's a corridor country.
I mean, basically, you're an amalgam of everything. On the east coast of Sicily, which would be the area Catania, Siracusa, Taormina, that area over there, it was originally inhabited by Greek and Roman. On the other side of the island, on the west side of the island, Palermo, Trapani, down to Agrigento, Sciacca. That area was not only Roman, but what happened was in the 10th century was conquered by the Arabs, the Moors from North Africa. And as a result, Sicilian cuisine is a blend of a whole bunch of different cultures. Roman, Greek, Arab, French, and most recently in the 17th and 18th century, Spanish.
Right.
So when someone says, what's a Sicilian, it's really an amalgam of a whole bunch of different gene pools.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm dark-haired, dark-eyed, and my father was a blue-eyed blonde.
Red-haired. My grandfather, Gaetano Torisi, was red-haired with blue eyes.
Yeah, there are whole towns in Sicily that with redheads. It was just amazing to see. Yeah. Now, this particular style of cooking called agrodolce comes about as a result. How would you describe it to somebody who doesn't know anything about it?
Aquadolce, I'm not familiar with that term, to be honest.
The sweet-sour.
Sweet and so what? It's a combination of sweet and sour products?
Yeah, like throwing some, doing a candle, a chickpea dish and putting in raisins, but vinegar.
You know, I'm not familiar with that type of cuisine, to be frank with you. Mike, the cuisine that we, on the east coast of Sicily, because my ancestors, so to speak, come from Tre Castagni, which is between Catania and Taormina. It was very much fish-based.
Oh, yeah.
Things like calamari, things like storku, which is a codfish, things like with the anchovies, things like, you know, basically that type of cuisine. And, of course, the mushroom. The mushroom is profoundly important to the cuisine diet, and obviously fresh fruits and vegetables. The esoteric combination of sweet and sour, I believe, is more indigenous to the west coast of Sicily.
Could be.
They've got some unbelievable combinations over there. I was just there 2 months ago, and I went into a restaurant, and you know, bear in mind that I lived there several months a year and a half for the last.
Oh, do I envy that?
Yeah, and there was about a half of the menu I couldn't recognize.
Yeah,
I had never seen some of the cuisine before.
You mean because it's new or because it's an area that you don't know?
Well, it's because it would, that particular place that we had gone to had more of an Arabic type of a cuisine.
Right.
And I just wasn't familiar with it.
That's like the couscous you get in Trapani,
That's correct.
Exactly.
That's correct. One of our products, though, was 2 years ago, we entered one of our nut creams. We found this little...
Oh, that's the thing I keep asking you to send me, the pistachio nut cream.
We're going to get them in this week.
Okay.
What happened?
I never had that in my life.
They come in, they sell out.
That's
the problem. I brought in 10,000 bottles in December, and we sold them out at the end of January. But this little company, a small little company from the west side of Mount Etna in Bronte, which is a small village reputed to have the best pistachios in Europe. We found this company, and we kind of developed them, and we entered them into the fancy food show in New York a year before. We go there every year, but we had to...
Oh, are you going to be there this year?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Maybe you'll have some pistachio cream that
definitely.
I can taste.
I'll make sure that you have some yet.
I could just
taste
it.
But anyways, you know, make a long story short, this particular company walked off with the gold. It's like... And the fancy food show, as you know, to win the gold medal at the fancy food show is like winning an Oscar in the team.
Oh, there are thousands and hundreds of thousands of products.
It was the first time that a Sicilian company had ever won the gold at the fancy food show. And it made all the newspapers over there and all the TV.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And as a result, the product is doing pretty good.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's a great product. And we have our oils coming from Palermo, from Manfredi Barbera. We private label under the name Villa St. Alfio. And just last year, our oil won the 5-star rating from Sante Magazine, which is the nation's one of the nation's largest organic magazines from Vermont. We were very pleased with that. We get a lot of our vegetable preserves from Shaka, which is a wonderful fishing area on the southwest portion of the island. So we basically kind of hit all over the place. You know,
now, who does that? Who actually sources these?
Me.
Oh, what a hard...
Yeah, I have a law office in Catania, and I also have a law partner there. And he and I, as I said, through different contacts that we've been able to get over the years, we find these folks. And none of them speak English, by the way. Sicily still is really much behind in bilingualism, and that's why their economy is not doing so hot in relation to the other EU countries, which are bilingual.
Listen.
So we take the company and we start from the label, translate the label, do the nutrition facts for them, come up with a marketing plan, the whole nine yards, and make it so that somebody who lives in Duluth, Minnesota, for example, and has nothing to do at all with Sicily, can understand the wonders of the product.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just looking through.
It's basically a labor of love.
I'm just looking through some of your offerings here. So these are things that nobody will get any other place but through your internet thing.
These
special oils, and then you also have special anchovies, tinned anchovies with anchovy fillet with parsley. Sounds wonderful.
Yep.
Artichokes.
We like people to go to the site to learn because we have lots of not basically sales stuff. I mean, we want to teach you. We want to teach you about the provinces of Sicily, the culture of Sicily, what the Italian people are like, what the Sicilian people are like. So we have 10,000,000 links on our site where you could spend lots of time on that site, and lots of folks do, by the way.
That's good.
And we have a newsletter that we, you know, I started a newsletter to some of my colleagues, some of my friends in the law schools that I happen to work at. 6 years ago, and they said, Giselle, this is great. Can I send it on to my friend? And here it is 6 years later. We have over 6,000 subscribers to our monthly newsletter, which I write. And basically, I just talk about my experiences in Sicily, different areas of Sicily, the culture of Sicily, and it goes all over the world. Folks really, really enjoy reading it. You have no idea how many emails I've gotten people who are saying to me, Al, thank you. It's like you've taken me to Sicily with you on your trip. And it makes me feel good. I mean, bear in mind, Ann, that Sicilians, there are 30 million Americans of Italian ancestry, 30 million. Out of that grouping, 12 million are of Sicilian ancestry. So it represents the largest subcomponent of Italians in America, primarily on the East Coast, you know, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and there's a very large population, too, in the state of Louisiana, where a lot of the fishermen went.
Oh, right, sure.
Yeah. So it's a wonderful thing that we're doing, and, you know, thank you so much for having me on the radio program.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, all I have to do is see the word. I'm so glad that I wanted to buy a property there, but they said unless you speak absolutely fluent Sicilian dialect, you might as well forget it.
Well,
now I've got you.
Yeah. I mean, I could urge anybody who is listening to your program who's of Sicilian background, I can urge them to try to, once in their lifetime or twice in their lifetime, go to Sicily. Because one of my life-altering experiences, I could still remember to this day, was the first time my feet hit the tarmac at Fontarossa Airport in Catania.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, Anne, when I tell you that every DNA molecule in my body told me that I was home.
Yeah, I agree.
Really, it's just a wonderful, wonderful, you know, La Sicilia is basically it. It's Isola La Bella, the island of beauty.
Yep.
And the most interesting thing of all in this day of age of the East versus the West clash of culture, so to speak, in Sicily, everybody lives, that Muslim and Christian, in peace and in harmony side by side.
Uh-huh.
It really could be a learning module, so to speak, of what's afflicting the world right now. If people just took the time to examine our beloved island a bit and find out what's going on in that particular portion of Europe, I think lots of folks would benefit.
Well, Alfred, I think that I was going to say you have a minute and you could make a closing remark, but actually I think that you made your closing remark.
Well, if you could,
and
visit our
I just think it's very exciting.
www.allthingssicilian.com.
Great.
And you could, if anybody would like to email me, you can just go right on the website and you can email me right from there or sign up for our newsletter or buy our products. Remember, when you buy our products, it goes to create a job in Sicily, A, and expose our cultural heritage in America, B. So basically, it's the best of both worlds.
Thank you, Alfred. And here comes the music chasing us out.
Okay,
I wish we had
so
longer to talk because there's so much more. And I hope to talk to you again.
Listen, I wish I could have more time to speak to you. And God bless you.
Thanks, Alfred.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And listeners, next time, same time, same station, same show. And for now, bye-bye.